Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, we again check in with Spokane Symphony Music Director James Lowe, still basically confined to quarters in Scotland. Chris Massini's guest is Dr. Doughty Abbe, Seattle-based professor, writer, and historian, who is one of the speakers in Spokane Community College's Diversity Dialogues series. Dan Webster drops by to offer his assessment of a new Netflix series, and will enjoy a bit of American music from the Spokane Piston and Rotary Club from their recent KPBX Kids Concert performance. This is Northwest Arts Review. We've checked in with Spokane Symphony Orchestra Music Director James Lowe each month during the pandemic. He's still pretty much confined to quarters outside Edinburgh, Scotland, but as we'll hear, still very much involved with the orchestra and hopeful that reuniting with them soon could become a reality.
Well, the situation across the UK is pretty much the same, unless you happen to live on one of the more remote Scottish islands. The whole country is pretty much on lockdown right now. It's pretty strict. It's back to pretty much where we were in April at the height of the pandemic. And our numbers here are pretty bad. They're climbing considerably. I think it's what, you know, we're seeing after the Christmas holidays season. People relaxed a bit. And I think there's a climb from that. But the vaccine is out there and we're getting it through the population. It's over 80s at the moment are getting it, so hopefully it's going to be creeping its way down the age bracket until it finds me.
Right. So in England, just generally speaking, and well, throughout Great Britain, 80 is the threshold. 80 and above is the threshold for the first group.
The first health workers. Tranche, yeah. They're looking for people, generally it's people in care homes and nursing homes over the age of 80 who are very susceptible, frontline workers, and I think some younger people who are in great danger, so they're getting it first. But there's a strange thing. They're now spacing the second dosage by up to 12 weeks. So nobody really knows how that's going to work. But we're just all crossing our fingers and just, you know, waiting for it to start to have a demonstrable effect in the community.
And are people, generally speaking, on board with the... Not that they have a real alternative, but just philosophically, are people in the general population on board with the restrictions and all?
I think so. The vast majority are. There are, of course, a vocal minority who are very much against any regulations and who deny the disease exists. But they are here quite in the minority. Most people understand that, well, they've just got to kind of suck it up, stay home and stay safe for a little bit longer. But I think now, knowing there's a vaccine, of course, being winter, it makes it rather harder, but knowing there's a vaccine out there that is coming down the pipeline really does help. And I think that small bit of optimism to start the year has been greatly appreciated.
I know that you were able early on in the pandemic, you were able to do some conducting gigs. I'm assuming that that's pretty much been shut down at this point.
It has. I did one. In fact, it's just been released last Friday. Find it if you like. It's on the Royal Scottish National Orchestra's website. If you Google RSNO concerts, it's the latest one they did. So that was recorded, I think, October, November time, and just been released now. But yeah, that production is shut down now. It's really the essential workers who are now kind of... working. Pretty much everybody else here is back staying at home.
Confined to quarters, as it were.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Which brings us to the topic of the Spokane Symphony, of course. And how are things going in terms of possibilities, in terms of planning? And I know there is just so much that is unknown and pretty much unknowable at this point.
That's always the case, isn't it? I mean, every time we talk, it's essentially the same thing. We did have a fantastic New Year's Eve online concert. So our holiday period was hugely busy, which was very nice. I actually produced the recording from here at 3 a.m. my time over Zoom. So it was a really brave new world of technology we were using. I was really pleased. I thought it was a great, fun concert, a very nice way to start the new year, rather a nice way to end the old year. And that's still up and will be up for quite a while yet. But off the back of that, we would love to record some more. And we're looking now at possibilities of me coming over. There are exemptions that you can get through the American Embassy in London, which we've applied for. So we'll see how that works. Of course, nobody really knows what's going to happen in the next few weeks. But if travel still is a possibility, then and I'm given the allowance to do so, then certainly the experience that I had of recording without audience, it was a very positive one. We actually recorded quite a large orchestra, Dvorak 9, we did over here. So it is possible to actually record ensembles on stage safely. So within CDC guidelines, of course, that's the plan. So we're just now waiting to see what the results of the application are and if and when I'll be on the next flight.
Right. Oh, it would be absolutely marvelous to have you back in the area. And I'm sure that you are quite keen to be back in front of your orchestra again. In terms of logistics, as you can answer this one, what is the maximum number of players that you might be able to get on stage at the Fox in order to make a recording?
That's a very good question. We're looking at certain guidelines, which to say, you know, you want 6 feet spacing between string players and more for wind and brass. We've also been looking at, you know, our HVAC system, the air conditioning system, and how quickly it turns over the air in the building. And we have a safety committee of musicians and staff to figure out exactly what we all agree is safe operating practices. So we're looking really, chamber orchestras are fine. We can, obviously strings, we can get more strings in, of course, because they take up less space, if you see what I mean. So what I'm looking at is a program that combines some nice chamber orchestra pieces, Haydn, Mozart, with some larger stuff for strings and wind and brass in different combinations. So showcasing the whole orchestra, but not necessarily all at the same time.
Right. And of course, that would open the door also to doing some Bach, some Handel, some more from the Baroque era, which kind of would prefer a smallish ensemble as opposed to the entire orchestra. That sounds really wonderful. So that's kind of where it is right now, isn't it? That's uncertainty is the thing.
Uncertainty is the thing. We're having to learning to live with uncertainty, I think, is a great skill we're all developing. We're also, though, running a parallel stream of education and outreach work, which is a little bit less based on the restrictions. So, for example, we did record some musicians for Spokane Public Schools for instrument demonstrations for their sixth graders who are just starting and are still only, I think, only now are just starting in-person lessons. We also had a lovely few sessions of virtual caroling over Zoom into some care homes in the area. And that was a trial balloon, really, for some work that we were planning on doing before in person, which is working with care homes and particularly dementia units where possible, because I think that's a place where the power of music is really palpable, and the change and help that we can bring as musicians to that segment of society, I think, is huge. So we're trying to develop right now a kind of digital way of doing that work with some actually colleagues of mine from over here. And one of them, Chica Robertson, is in fact a Spokaneite originally, and who is now one of the world's great experts in music and dementia. So, yes, she's a wonderful person. If people, I think a load of people still know her in town, but she's really worth following up the work she does because it's hugely inspiring.
The human brain is an amazing instrument, if you will. And it's been pretty well documented that music is one of the things that is still in there somewhere, even though someone is afflicted and very seriously with dementia.
Absolutely. I feel, well, I have a long theory about this, so I won't bore you with all of it, but I really do think that language is a subset of music. That is to say, the first thing we learn is intonation. When you talk to a baby, you overemphasize the tone. My dog doesn't necessarily understand the words that I say, but he certainly understands the tone of voice in which I say it. So I think firstly we understand tone and shape and the melody of language, and then the language itself, as we grow older, becomes subsumed and becomes part of us. So I think it's therefore entirely natural that as it's the first language we learn, it's probably the last language that we lose at the other end. So I really do feel that this emotional connection that music brings is still the most direct line between two human beings of any age.
Well said. I think that's a good place to leave it. And with hope in our hearts that there are better days ahead, and perhaps those better days will involve your traveling here to Spokane and perhaps actually sitting in one of our studios one of these days. So, you know, there.
I would love to do that.
That sounds wonderful. You can access the Spokane Symphony's New Year's concert offerings at spokanesymphony.org and check James Lowe's performance with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra at rsno.org.uk. The Spokane Piston and Rotary Club, a low brass ensemble, performed in the last KPBX Kids concert, reprising a bit of their performance on Northwest Arts Review during this inauguration week seems appropriate, particularly this best known of all Sousa marches, The Stars and Stripes Forever. You can access the full Spokane Piston and Rotary Club Kids Concert program as a From the Studio podcast at spokanepublicradio.org. The new Netflix miniseries based on the bodice ripper romance Bridgerton is a fantastical reinvention of history. Definitely not Downton Abbey, says Dan Webster in this review.
My late brother Randy was an Anglophile. He could recite the entire succession of British monarchs. What's more interesting, he could speak at length about the various controversies and scandals that rocked so many of the royal courts. It was always a pleasure to watch, say, an episode of Upstairs, Downstairs, Downton Abbey, or The Crown with them, not to mention any of the films featuring British rulers from Henry II to Queen Elizabeth II. He could spot immediately both the anachronisms, how characters wore their wigs, for example, and the inaccuracies of fact. I wonder, then, what Randy would think of Bridgerton, the 8-part Netflix miniseries whose first and so far only season is set in 1813, during the reign of King George III and Queen Charlotte. Based on one of the storylines adapted from the 8-novel historical romance series written by Julia Quinn, Bridgerton has about as much in common with, say, The Crown as Tom Brown's School Days does with the many adventures of Harry Potter. The former is an artistic representation of real events, while the latter is pure fantasy, however arguably artistic. The first season of Bridgerton focuses on the Bridgerton family, particularly on the eldest daughter, Daphne, played by Phoebe Dienavor, who emerges as the season's leading debutante, while her eldest brother, Anthony, played by Jonathan Bailey, seeks to arrange a marriage for her. Daphne resists his initial choice and instead is drawn into a ruse, that's the word they use, with Anthony's BFF, the dashing Simon, Duke of Hastings, played by Regé Jean Page. Daphne and the Duke pretend to be courting. This allows Daphne to attract a number of acceptable suitors, and it takes the pressure off the Duke to marry at all. His own reasons for not wanting to wed have to do with a pledge he made to his dying father, whose harsh treatment of his only heir, not to mention the heir's late mother, he considers unforgivable. "Our line," he tells dear old dad, "dies with me." Here's where things get complicated, though. Through their play acting, the couple grows close, and as things happen, sometimes in real life, but most assuredly in fiction, the two eventually fall in love, which leads to a compromising situation. Season one has a number of other plot lines, too. One involves Anthony's affair with an opera singer, a woman whom a man of his position could never marry. Another follows the Featherington family, whose patriarch is an inveterate gambler and whose matriarch, played by Polly Walker, has a distant cousin, played by Ruby Barker, who is pregnant yet unmarried. No small problem for a woman, especially then. Other characters include two more of Daphne's brothers, one of whom gets acquainted with the secretive side of British society, the other of whom gets targeted in a marriage of convenience scheme. Then there is Daphne's younger sister, Eloise, played by Claudia Jesse, who bridles against any kind of expectation that she should, like her sister, follow societal norms. Eloise, it turns out, is BFFs with one of the Featherington clan, the young Penelope, played by Nicola Coughlan, who is upset at Marina's plan to entrap Daphne's brother. And recording all this is the secretive gossip monger known only as Lady Whistledown, voiced by Julie Andrews. The Regency period's equivalent of the New York Post's infamous Page Six, Lady Whistledown's reports both intrigue and horrify members of the court, all the way up to those who wear the crown. Indeed, it is Queen Charlotte, played by Golda Rochevelt, who attempts to set up her nephew, Prince Friedrich of Prussia, played by Freddie Stroma, with Daphne, a relationship that threatens to upend the obvious path of love between Daphne and her duke. Okay, you might say, nothing new to see here. There, though, you would be wrong, because though this bodice ripper of a series of features a bit of nudity and a fair amount of steamy sex, the overall conceit is similar to that of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway musical Hamilton, in which black actors play famous white actors. Bridgerton, too, takes historical liberties by inserting black characters into positions they almost certainly would not have filled in real life. Not that series creator Chris Van Dusen or his team of screenwriters make race much of an issue, pointing to the suspicion of some historians that Queen Charlotte herself was of mixed race. Van Dusen told the New York Times that he merely imagined an alternative history in which the Queen used her influence to transform the roles that people of color played in English society. And why not? Imagination is the source of all our myths. If that's a controversial decision, it's one that might have made my brother smile. At least I like to think so. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. Movies 101 airs on KPBX every Friday evening at 6:30 and podcasts from SpokanePublicRadio.org.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini. My guest today is Dr. Dowdy Abe, a Seattle-based professor, writer, and historian who has taught and written about culture, race, gender, education, communication, hip-hop, and sports for over 20 years. His latest book is Emerald Street, A History of Hip-Hop in Seattle. Abe is one of this year's speakers at the Hagen Center for the Humanities at Spokane Community College for their series Diversity Dialogues, Conversations about Race and Equity. He'll be hosting a live virtual event on Wednesday, January 27th. Dowdy Abe, thanks so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I want to talk about your event coming up next week, but before that, maybe touch briefly on your new book on hip-hop in the Northwest. So I've heard you define hip-hop as the preeminent youth culture of the post-civil rights era. So with that lofty sort of definition in mind, I wonder if you could start with that and sort of trace that lineage of the connection between hip-hop and civil rights and today's social justice movements, particularly those roots in the Northwest.
Well, the story of hip-hop is really the story of society. And so tracing kind of back to the origins, we're talking about the 1970s. And here you have this kind of perfect socio-political economic storm kind of confluence of events, one of which is about the post-civil rights era and how as you started to get into the 70s, kind of the promise of the Civil Rights Act had begun to fade a little bit. I think that there was probably a lot of excitement around the country and urban communities around the passage of that legislation. But as the years and then kind of decades start to go on, the changes kind of promised in the realities of the ground in a lot of these communities, there was a serious disconnect. And so not only that, but also you have economic recession. And the way that this kind of trickles down is that, you know, quite often there are, you know, educational cutbacks in these situations. You know what I'm saying? The first programs usually to go are what? Art and music. And so, you know, you had people, you had young kids who were struck by the creative urge, not only in the South Bronx, but in places all over the country where all of a sudden, perhaps their only access to these types of materials at school was gone. So even though the opportunities, the formal opportunities in school were taken away, the creative urge was still there. And you can really see about how hip-hop is literally the story of creating something from nothing. And it's so funny because, you know, hip-hop really isn't even supposed to be here. If you look at where it came from and who the kids were that were creating it and pushing it out in the world, it's really a miracle that especially for someone like me who was, you know, lucky enough to kind of witness the birth of it and how it spread and how it affected different communities like Seattle. It's really remarkable the transition and the journey that this culture has undertaken.
Well, that's an interesting transition, which is, you know, hip hop sort of had its roots, as you mentioned, in the Bronx and New York, and then sort of spread to LA, but really quickly spread throughout the whole country and the world. So I wonder, particularly in Seattle in the Northwest, how did that start to happen, and what sort of particular, you know, influences or flavor did folks in the Northwest bring to that movement?
Well, it spreads nationwide in the fall of 1979 with the release of Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. And that's really kind of the moment of inflection, I guess you could call it, that hip hop becomes mobile. This was the first nationally and internationally distributed record. And so it arrives in different places. And so it gets here and, you know, people start hearing Rapper's Delight on the radio. Kids start hearing it. And, you know, soon after kind of learning the words of the song themselves and trying it themselves, it becomes quickly apparent that you have to pull from the regional cultural stockpile as it existed at the time to make your attempts relevant. People in Seattle were not going to rap about subways or, you know what I mean, 30-story public housing buildings because those are not the realities of life in Seattle. But one thing that did definitely influence it was this kind of regional isolation that we experience up here in the corner of the country. In terms of creativity, where people have not felt the need to necessarily copy what other peoples are doing in any significant way. The success of those artists was directly linked to their willingness to take artistic risk and go out of their way to not try to do or sound like anything anybody else is doing.
I'm talking with Dr. Dowdy Abe, Seattle-based professor, writer, historian, and upcoming speaker for Spokane Community College's Hagen Center Speaker Series on Diversity Dialogues. So you're obviously a scholar of hip-hop and culture, but also of education. And as you mentioned earlier, there's definitely a connection between the two. The topic of your event on the 27th with SCC is, why are all the Black kids sitting together in the principal's office? So those disparities in education, I think, have been well documented. But getting at the root of those problems and then finding a way to address them has obviously been much more challenging. So what's your approach to that very broad and complicated question?
First of all, if we're talking about disparities in discipline, you know, that was a topic of my dissertation that I did at the University of Washington. And as I was doing research around that, I came across kind of an interesting concept, the idea of subjective versus objective discipline. And so if we're talking about objective disciplinary stuff, we're talking about, you know, fights on the playground where somebody punches somebody in the head, or, you know, somebody bringing a weapon to school or something like that, something where there's not a lot of room for interpretation, versus subjective discipline. And these subjective discipline, you know, covers issues like disruptive conduct or rule breaking or disobedience. And so what I was doing, what I was finding as I was doing this research, was that more than 50% of the reasons for African-American students being suspended and expelled fell under the subjective disciplinary categories. And so I'm not saying that there aren't kids who are being disobedient or breaking the rules or being disruptive. But what I am saying is that when you have, you know, say a student body made up of 22% African-American kids and they account for almost 50% of suspensions and expulsions in the district, that's enough to start asking questions. And so those questions about what is it that these subjective things are kind of getting in the way, it's the idea of teachers being aware. And, you know, I'm part of a partnership between Seattle Public Schools and Seattle Central College called the Academy for Rising Educators. And the whole purpose of this program is to raise teachers who are culturally responsive and who work with a student-centered model. Because I'm less worried about teaching candidates, you know, saying being able to construct a lesson plan and knowing what an anticipatory set is and figuring out assessments. Those technical aspects, I think a lot of teachers are fine at. Where the problem lies is so many of them are not having real and substantive conversations, not only about their own attitudes toward race, but also historically how race has impacted the outcome for so many students of color. And that is a central part of this training program, about training these teachers and getting them trained and certified and back in the classrooms where they are racially competent and fully aware that race governs so much of what happens in the classroom. It's very similar to policing. In fact, you know, I also do work at the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission on working on implementing a history of race and policing curriculum, because I think it's the same thing there. I think so many police officers get on the street and have not had any serious conversations, again, about their own attitudes toward race and how those attitudes may impact the way they do their jobs within the larger context of an institution that has had historically bad outcomes for communities of color.
My guest has been Dr. Dowdy Abe, professor, writer, and historian based in Seattle. He'll be hosting a live virtual event on Wednesday, January 27th, with Spokane Community College's Hagen Center Speaker Series, Diversity Dialogues, Conversations About Race and Equity. You can find details about that event on our website, spokanepublicradio.org, under our events tab. Dowdy Abe, thank you much for taking the time to talk with me.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Messini. We're grateful as well for the contributions of James Lowe, Dr. Dowdy Abe, and Dan Webster. Taking us out, some Scott Joplin from the Spokane Piston and Rotary Club. John Church and Kit Cutler, euphoniums. Jerry Olson and Leonard Byrne, tubas. Please do join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review. Thank you.